Jesus' farewell discourse in the Gospel of John, Jesus says in 15:13, "No one has greater love than to give one's life for one's friend." Loving our neighbor can be seen through the supreme sacrifice of laying down your life for another. This is what Jesus does for us, and as followers of Christ, we should be willing to do the same. In the Game of Thrones, sacrifices are made. People give up their lives in order to save others. However, some do it voluntarily, and others are forced to. Sacrifice is the topic we explore in this week's episode. We hope you subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you listen to us on, and please leave us a rating and review so that the world can know that you are enjoying this podcast. Please share with your friends and help us get the word out as well. You can continue our conversation on our Facebook page at facebook.com/theologyof, or if you have any questions, comments, or whatever, you can contact us at theologyofpodcast@gmail.com. I'm Jim Parsons, and with me is Wes Smith. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Theology Of, a podcast about seeing God in the ordinary. So sacrifice seems to be all over the Game of Thrones in all different kinds of ways. So I know, Wes, you're looking at a couple of different ways that we see sacrifice in this series.
There are a number of characters, and we can't talk about every kind of sacrificial act or sacrificial death that happens in Game of Thrones. We just don't have the time. So we both picked a couple of characters, and the one that comes to mind to me immediately would be Theon Greyjoy. And to kind of give a little bit of background for Theon, this is going to just hit the high points because his narrative gets really complex, especially in seasons 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah,
I mean it gets pretty twisty. So we'll just hit the high spots and kind of just follow his arc and kind of what makes his sacrifice really meaningful. Mm-hmm. In season 1, we meet Theon, and we're told, or we learn that he's a ward. Basically, a ward of Winterfell. Like he's not Ned Stark's son. Mm-hmm. We find out later he was taken by Ned Stark to ensure that Theon's father, King Balon Greyjoy, would not break the terms of his surrender, because he surrendered. The people of the Iron Islands surrendered to Robert Baratheon. A whole lot of complex stuff behind that. But Theon was taken to make sure Balon would not rebel against Robert Baratheon. Mm-hmm. So he's staying with Ned, which is probably, given what we learn about Balon Greyjoy later on, the best situation for Theon would be to live with the Starks. Mm-hmm. And when we first meet him, he seems to be to get along well with him. I mean, there's some awkwardness and tension there, but we learn that he's not at home. And then a lot of twists and turns happen in season 2. Theon turns against the Starks, and he claims to have killed the youngest Stark sons, Rickon and Bran, but actually he killed 2 local farm boys and burns them, basically burns them alive, and kills them and tells everybody that they were the youngest Stark kids. Word gets back to Rob. I think word gets back to Rob, and Theon is now a marked man. But in seasons 3 and 4, through a lot of narrative twists and turns, Theon becomes a prisoner of Ramsay Snow. And Ramsay Snow is perhaps the most sadistic, psychopathic villain in the entire series, perhaps equaled only by Joffrey.
Yeah, they would have a run for their money to who was the worst of them. But
Ramsay's a piece of work, man. He is something else.
I think Ramsay would get my vote.
Yeah, when anytime he appeared on the screen in this whole kind of run, kind of arc we had with Theon, you're just kind of, you get this sinking feeling in your stomach, like, how much more can poor Theon take? Ramsay does unspeakable things to Theon, and he breaks him down completely, kind of robs him of his identity, and he forces him to assume the new identity of Reek, mm-hmm. who is a completely compliant servant and envoy of Ramsay Snow, who becomes Ramsay Bolton. Mm-hmm. Sansa appears and is basically taken hostage, kidnapped by Ramsay, but kind of forced to become his quote unquote wife.
Mm-hmm.
Theon slash Reek is instrumental in this happening. And a bunch of horrible stuff happens that I'm not going to talk about. I just assume forget about it. And then we're going to skip ahead by saying that Theon and his sister Yara are reunited. They're double-crossed by their uncle Euron. Theon winds up back in the good graces of the Starks. And at the end, in the last season, he gives his life to save Bran.
Mm-hmm.
Night King and the White Walkers have appeared, and Theon is... with a group of other Ironborn, and Theon charges to protect Bran's life. And before he does this, Bran tells Theon that he is a good man. And this is understanding that Bran, which you'll talk about this a little bit later, related to another sacrifice. Bran sees everything, can see everything in the past. So he can see Theon's journey completely.
Right.
And so when he tells Bran that he's a good man, and just Theon's reaction to this, the look on his face, like his narrative arc is complete.
Yeah.
And he's been given validation by a Stark.
Mm-hmm.
And he willingly sacrifices himself to protect Bran, and so ends the life of one of the people who endured the most suffering and psychological torment of any character in a show full of psychological torment.
I'd have to say, like, in that last season when he does kind of rush the White Walkers and the King, I was kind of happy with how they wrapped that narrative arc up.
Me too.
You know, because it's kind of like, hey, there's redemption in this sacrificial death to save Bran.
And so in thinking about Theon, I began, kind of asking myself, why does Theon interest me? And, you know, I like his journey from selfishness to selfless sacrifice. And in Theon's journey, there's a lot of questions about identity and agency and what causes us to lose our identity and how can we reclaim it. And there's a question, you kind of hinted at this. There's a question that does intrigue me. Does Theon have to die sacrificially in order to achieve redemption?
Hmm.
And... I think for the purposes of the narrative, yes,
mm-hmm.
because that kind of ties up a loose end,
right?
In terms of the narrative, I think in terms of real life, obviously, I think if you've done really really bad things, it doesn't necessarily require you to die.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get into more of that kind of question later on in the episode, but. That's why I found Theon and his sacrifice intriguing. And, you know, with Theon, his sacrifice, it was chosen. Like he had a moment where he had a moment of decision.
Right.
You know, Theon in seasons 1 and 2, put in that very same situation, he would have dropped his sword and run.
Right.
But his journey led him to be at a place that he made kind of a courageous selfless choice, and he made a choice. And so one of the things we're going to kind of be going back and forth about with the other characters is when it comes to sacrifices, for some who demonstrated sacrifice, there wasn't a choice.
Right.
Unless you have anything else about Theon, I can move to the next character.
Well, and I think you're right. The character arc with Theon was probably one of the most satisfying ones of the whole show, because when he does kind of make that choice to be selfless, you know, you saw how he was selfish in the beginning, in the early seasons, and then, you know, wanting all the power back to himself and, you know, the horrible things he did in Winterfell. But then when you see his journey of being just basically rock bottom as Reek, and then the slow progression back up to a person who could own who he is, and then to give of himself to save another person is great storytelling.
I gotta admit, like I am harboring a little bit of resentment for having to research Theon's story again. reading the details, like it's just like Ramsay Bolton was a very effective character, because the person I compare him to would be Dolores Umbridge in Harry Potter.
Right.
Like, like you just you hate them. And I didn't feel any sympathy to Theon. Like it wasn't like when he was kidnapped, I wasn't like a Theon fan. Mm-hmm. You know, I was not Team Theon. but given just nobody deserves ever at any point in time what Ramsay did.
Yeah.
So just
What's the next one?
The next one is it's a bit of like a kind of a out of left field kind of character, and this character is if Theon's kind of bumping right up against major character territory. I don't think he doesn't really get into that list of the major characters.
He's definitely a high second tier character.
High second tier. This one third, maybe fourth tier. So yeah. Talking about Shireen Baratheon.
But everybody knows the scene.
I would think so. If you've watched the series, you remember the scene. It's and you probably remember a little bit about the story arc. Now there were, and for me, the scene was impactful because I forgot she was in the series for like three seasons. Mm-hmm. And before I kind of refreshed my memory, I thought it was just one. But she was a minor enough character. She didn't have a whole lot of scenes, and they were spread across a long period of time.
Yeah.
And she's actually the one that kind of got Davos Seaworth she thrust him into the narrative in a certain kind of allowed him to enter the narrative in a more prominent way. And he's one of my favorite characters. So good job, Shireen.
She taught him to read, right?
She did teach him to read. Okay. And was, I think, according to what I read, and I'd forgotten this completely, was willing to teach Gilly to read as well. Hmm. But Shireen is actually a truly innocent victim. And she's one of the few characters in Game of Thrones in the series, the TV show, with basically a pure heart, unselfish. And so, of course, she has to die. That's just the rules of Game of Thrones. Right. She's also a survivor of Greyscale, mm-hmm. which figures prominently with Jorah Mormont later on. But she's scarred. Mm-hmm. And but she is the daughter of Stannis and Cersei Baratheon. Stannis being the brother of Robert Baratheon, and when Robert dies, Stannis has a claim on the throne, the Iron Throne. Stannis is basically advised. His chief advisor basically is Melisandre, the woman in red. But Melisandre also has a stronghold on Stannis' wife Cersei. And of course, Davos serves Stannis, and Davos learns to read from Shireen teaches him how to read.
Yeah.
And Davos, due to Melisandre's machinations, Davos is imprisoned in the dungeon as a traitor. And Shireen, that's where Shireen continues to meet with him and teach him to read. She's killed by Melisandre as a sacrifice offered to, let's see if I pronounce this right, R'hllor, otherwise known as the Lord of Light.
Yeah, we covered this in the last episode.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. You focus on the Lord of Light there. Shireen is killed because Melisandre claims that the only thing that will allow them to have victory in battle is the spilling of blood. Innocent blood, I think she says. And so she convinces, and it's almost like Cersei especially, because Stannis, when Melisandre advises him to kill Shireen, Stannis is horrified. Cersei goes along with it, and then Stannis relents, but it's almost like as soon as they light the fire under Shireen, it's like the spell is broken, and Cersei realizes what she's done.
Yeah.
And if memory serves, I think Cersei winds up killing herself because of that.
Yes. She hangs herself.
She hangs herself. And then
I think.
Then Stannis is killed later in battle. But the one side note about this, the crazy thing about this show is when we meet Melisandre in those first couple of seasons, she is like a unambiguous villain.
Mm-hmm.
Like she is in the villain category. She is deceptive. We at one point see her true form. She takes that necklace off, right. And we see true form. And she is the first up through the sacrifice of Shireen. She is just a horrible person. But in the last season, you know, she's moved into, like, if not a protagonist, I wouldn't think, she's not an outright villain.
Like, well, she's got the and the reason why the sacrifice is happening kind of goes back to last episode talking about who the light bringer or the savior is going to be.
Yeah.
And she thinks that's, you know,
yeah, right,
Serene's
right.
dad, and that's doesn't ends up not being the case, which then her attention turns to John.
Yes.
So, you know, her motives kind of come out in the later seasons where you don't know exactly what's happening earlier on.
Right. Yeah, and some of this, like, these storylines are so complex. Like, I, you know, it's easy to miss details over a lot of these seasons. But right after I thought about Theon, Shireen came to mind for me, and just thinking about why she interests me. I think Shireen's death gives a window into the show's perspective about how the world operates. And it's a continuation of the theme. It's kind of fits in with Ned Stark's death.
Mm-hmm.
In the world of Game of Thrones, that which is good and pure and honorable has to be killed. And what winds up winning the day, ambition is more of a motivator than honor.
Mm-hmm.
In Game of Thrones. And so what you see is if you're too trusting or too good or too selfless, for the most part, you're going to die.
Yeah. It'll be chewed up and spit out.
Yep. And it's one of the few examples. There are a couple other examples, but one of the few examples of religious ritual sacrifice, certainly the most prominent. But I think this is also kind of a window into how Game of Thrones, maybe George R. R. Martin and the show creators, how they view kind of not all religion, but I think they're probably embedded in there some commentary on the potential destructive role of religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that's how they view that is what I agree with, but I think that commentary is in there. Like people with ulterior motives and with ambition can use religion as a means to control and to destroy.
Yeah.
That point I certainly agree with, and we've seen that throughout human history.
Mm-hmm.
So the sacrifice of Theon was chosen. The sacrifice of Shireen was not chosen by Shireen. She was offered as a sacrifice on behalf of another person.
Yeah.
And so.
And it was. I mean, that scene is hard to watch.
Yeah, I didn't go back and watch the scene. Once was enough.
Yeah, I was a glutton for punishment. I went back and watched it, and yeah, it's just the scream at the very end of the scene is just like,
I couldn't do it.
but I think that's a great lead in, you know, people who choose to die or sacrifice themselves versus those who are sacrificed for another. And so, you know, when we talked about this theme of sacrifice for this episode, my mind first went to Hodor and like, oh, it's a great story of him, you know, holding back the door. We learn how we get said Hodor and you know, I thought, oh, it's a great story of, you know, him. You know, sacrificing himself for the person he's in charge of keeping safe.
So noble.
Yes. Then I start looking into it more, and it's maybe not as noble as I thought.
Not so much.
So to kind of give a synopsis of who Hodor is, he was this stable hand in Winterfell named Willis, and we only learn this later on in the series. As Bran is much older and is learning from the Three-Eyed Raven. And so we'll start with Bran himself. So Bran is in the first episode, he catches Jaime and Cersei intertwined in incest and is pushed out the window. And, mm-hmm. and he falls and he's basically paralyzed from the waist down. And so, you know, they don't have mechanical wheelchairs, so they got to figure out some way to carry this, you know, kid around eventually, and Hodor, who is this kind of simple-minded, very big, strong man, and Winterfell is the one who is kind of tasked to take him around. I think they had a different harnesses to carry him and different ways to kind of pull him along. And
they wound up with something like a dog sled, didn't they? Kind of like a
wasn't like a wheelbarrow and. It varied like every episode or every season. It kind of
transformed
as he kind of went in search for this tree where the Three-Eyed Raven would be. So, but in this last scene where Hodor actually holds the door, Bran is using his gift of green sight to go back in the past to kind of see what was happening. And I can't remember exactly why they went back to this certain moment. It's probably so that Hodor could become Hodor. But Bran is watching Willis kind of interact and helping teach. And you can tell he's got a very clear mind. He's very personable. He's got a personality. He's nothing like the, you know, Hodor that we know. He's Willis. Yep. And then things in the present, he can kind of hear happening. And the White Walkers are trying to attack. They're trying to kill the Three-Eyed Raven and Bran. And so they're in this tunnel, and there's a lot, you know, fight scene, almost like zombies coming after, kind of a Walking Dead type of moment. Right. And so Bran and his abilities can sense a little bit of what's going on. And him and I think it's what's her name? Mara, that's it. Mara. We're escaping. And Mira, that's it. Mira.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Eventually we get there.
So they were escaping, and they needed time to get away. And so one of Bran's other main kind of gifts is to warg, which means to kind of take over. He took over some animals in the series to kind of help defend him and some other people. And then he learned, because of Hodor's simple mind, he could take over Hodor and has him fight off some of the people during, you know, his journey as well. So if we can follow this along, with Bran in the past, he wargs into Willis to then have Willis in the future hold back the door so that he can escape.
That's just cold, man.
It is. And so what you realize is Bran is really and this warging in the past sends Willis into kind of what looks like a seizure. And he just continues to say over and over again, hold the door, hold the door, hold the door, which then, as his mind kind of drifts, turns into Hodor, Hodor. And, you know, the whole world is crushed.
Yes. Yeah. And I think your explanation, that's a very good job explaining that. Because I think the first time you watch it, and like a lot of people do, you're watching it kind of like, you know, probably playing on your phone at the same time.
Yeah.
Kind of half paying attention. You're like, oh, look at Hodor. He's a hero.
Right.
And then when you kind of start to put the pieces together, like, you know, oh, look at Bran. He's a monster.
Yeah, because Bran is just simply using this kid to then turn into this. There's no story. There's no storyline with Hodor anymore that Bran is not using him. That he's, you know, not a tool for Bran just to simply survive and become the Three-Eyed Raven, which eventually we know then he becomes the Sit on the Iron Throne.
Which puts a whole other spin on the end of the story.
Oh, yeah.
Because all of a sudden, like, you thought this was like a just way to end it, like the right person is king.
Yeah, but you look back and you're like, wait a second.
Hold on here.
Is this being manipulated the whole time by Bran? Who knows? Because then he's got that smart, you know, Alec kind of teenager response at the very last scene when they're like, you know, well, maybe Bran could do it. And he's like, well, why else would I come down here?
Yeah, that's right. You know, what else do you think I'm here?
Like,
okay, yeah.
All right, yeah. With the teenagers in my house, I hear that tone quite often.
Yeah. If this show were made in the early 90s, he would probably say, duh.
That's right. But, you know, so the Hodor story, which, you know, he gives himself up and he is ripped to shreds by these White Walkers or whatever they're called, the zombies, basically. And, you know, it's just people are – I remember seeing the memes that came out later of, you know, yelling people to hold the door. And
yeah.
But, you know, it's a very sad moment because, you know, they cherish this big, lumbering, sweet, gentle person. Which, when you go to the past and you kind of see that scene, you can see how caring he was to the Starks and teaching them different things. And he was, you know, helping them out. He was a very useful, stable boy. And then Bran is just simply using him the whole time.
And he appeared to have, you know, affection for Bran, if memory serves. Like he wanted to help.
Yes.
And then to see, it's just tragic.
It is. And so it took a tragic moment of just Hodor dying to a whole nother level when you go, oh, he's dying and being used all at the same time.
Yeah.
So yeah, going back and watching that scene again, which I did, I'm just a glutton for punishment this week. You know, it's just, it brought up like, oh my goodness, this poor character.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of that in Game of Thrones. There's a ton of people who are being used or killed or sacrificed so that others can then live or gain power or, you know, in Bran's case, eventually gain the throne.
Right.
You have anything else on Hodor before I move on?
That little bit of what you just said there, like thinking about this show as a whole and kind of Hodor's place in it. I mean, a similar thing, this idea of people being used as pawns. I mean, for all intents and purposes, isn't that the same thing we do in war?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What we do with soldiers. So I think there's a – I mean, like we said before, like Game of Thrones, the view of the world and of humanity in Game of Thrones is really cynical. Mm-hmm. And so this just further highlights kind of that cynicism. But it's hard to argue that there's not something to that.
Yeah. Well, and I think it speaks to, like, you know, the upper class versus the working class. You know, Bran's a, quote, royal, if you want to say, you know, say that. He's from the House of Stark. He's not a simple stable boy. So those people are there to serve him. So, you know, Bran probably doesn't give it a second thought because that's what Hodor's job is.
Right.
But there's another character that really kind of twists and turns and uses people and sacrifices many people to gain power within Westeros, and that's Littlefinger. Peter Baelish, or Pitcher, I forget how you say his last name. I know it's Baelish. The Y's that are thrown into names throw me, so I apologize. But Baelish, Littlefinger, Lord Varys says that there's this one scene where he says that Littlefinger is the most dangerous man in Westeros.
Mm.
Because he doesn't come from anything, yet he has built up, you know, power and a listening ear with many of the people in power, and he's very cunning to twist things into his own way.
Yes.
And we see that immediately in season one, because he's the one who gets Ned Stark killed through his betrayal. He really starts the War of the Five Kings. He's the one who kind of really is the puppet master pulling a lot of strings very early on, but then also, I mean, it continues to follow him throughout the series. But for those who, to go back to Bran, when Bran is paralyzed in the very beginning of season one, an assassin is sent to kind of finish off the job to make sure that Jaime and his relationship with his sister doesn't come out. And the assassin is holding a very specific weapon. It's a dagger that is where in my notes is it?
It's made of dragon glass, right?
Yeah, it's a dragon glass, and it's got like a certain. It basically points to Tyrion.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't it called the Cat's Paw?
Yes, Cat's Paw. Yeah. There it is. A Valyrian steel dagger. That is that's used to attempt the assassination of Bran, which Littlefinger then blames Tyrion for. So then all of a sudden Starks versus the Lannisters, you know, kind of ratchets it up a notch. But in fact, it's Baelish it's Littlefinger who's, you know, sent the assassin and the dagger all at once. So, you know, he's happy to sacrifice main characters like Ned Stark so that he can keep the power. But what's interesting is some of the motives behind Littlefinger is that he's always been in love with Ned Stark's wife, Catelyn. So, you know, Catelyn or Catherine? I can't remember. Catelyn.
Catelyn,
thank you. And so he's always in love with her and always wants to be with her and thought he had a chance at one point, and then Ned kind of gets wind of it and, you know, kind of puts him in his place. And that's also what leads to him betraying Ned and having him killed. So, yeah, Littlefinger's a very devious person who does not mind whatsoever killing off people so that or sacrificing them so his power continues.
Yeah, and I got to say one of my favorite characters in the show, mainly because I don't know the actor's name, the actor did such a great job portraying this kind of slimy, you know, untrustworthy character. So I loved watching his machinations mm-hmm. in the series.
Oh yeah, he's got that. The way he played him was like, this person can be a nobody, or then all of a sudden appear and be somebody.
Yeah,
you know, he's always working in the back in the shadows, and yeah, he's a puppet master. He's working the strings and the marionettes of those, and all hoping that he could eventually gain more and more power. There's another scene later on. I forget exactly what season this was, but he's trying to Lisa Aaron up in the Vale,
right?
Kind of helps her kill off John, and then eventually when they try to push my names are escaping me. Sansa. She was going to try to get rid of Sansa by pushing her out the moon door. And Littlefinger says, nope, and then pushes her out the moon door.
Yes.
And this kind of like reminded me of the 300 in Sparta scene where he just pushes her and falls.
This is Sparta.
That's right. This is the Vale.
And which is going to come back, which and one of the few instances in this show where what I feel like justice is actually served.
Yeah.
Because that act comes back to bite him in the last season.
Yep. We don't want to spoil that because we got that coming up in a couple episodes when we talk about justice.
Okay. That's a teaser.
That's right. But yeah, I 100% agree. That comes out later to bite him, and what then happens is great.
Oh, that is one scene I will rewatch with
joy.
Yes.
So you know, look, when we think about the idea of sacrifice, not only of giving of oneself, but then also taking a life or sacrificing a life for your own power. So that's one. Hodor and then Littlefinger started to pop up to me. It was like, you know what? This is a person who doesn't care. Human life does not mean much except as a means to gain power and position.
Right.
So let's transition and let's see where sacrifice comes up in Scripture.
Well, I mean, the obvious starting point is, you know, basically what our entire faith is based on.
Yes.
An act of sacrifice, being the death of Jesus. But I do think there's an interesting question here when we talk about, you know, first of all, with Theon and Shireen, and then especially with Hodor, about agency.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and this idea of, or question, was Jesus a victim? You know, what was the extent of the agency and his choice in his death? Mm-hmm. I remember my home church, the choir, occasionally as an anthem, would sing the song "He Could Have Called 10,000 Angels," kind of related to this idea that when he's standing before Pilate, Jesus could at any point have stopped the proceedings
mm-hmm.
in any number of ways, so that the path of sacrifice that Jesus chose was more similar to kind of Theon's choice than it would have been to like Shireen or especially of course Hodor. So I think there's to me at least, there's an interesting conversation in there about kind of to what extent was Jesus a victim?
Right. Was it his choice to be crucified, or was it he was just the one being sacrificed? Does that speak to kind of the idea of atonement and the different ideas of atonement, or is that beyond that?
Well, I think there's. Because one of the things that I tend to believe as it relates to the crucifixion of Jesus and kind of related to the atonement theory that is called Christus Victor, that through the death, his death on the cross, Jesus Christ is victorious, and that part of the revelatory or the revelation of the cross is to reveal the kind of the sinfulness of the world. And and it kind of connects back to what I said about Shireen, that, you know, she was kind of an innocent. She was pure of heart. So, of course, she has to die. And, you know, looking at in our world, in the real world, that the way the world responded to Jesus, Jesus wasn't a victim in the pure sense in terms of Jesus was not powerless. But the men who or the people who had him crucified, they made that choice to kill a man who was innocent. So in one sense, he was a victim, but it was a revealing of the brokenness of the world. So in that sense, it was a sacrifice. And, you know, it kind of demonstrates how Jesus or how the world responds to the grace and goodness and holiness of God. And so there, I think there is a parallel there with Game of Thrones as well.
Well, I think in John's gospel, John has a different timeline than the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where that instead of the Last Supper being kind of the Passover meal, that the crucifixion is happening on Passover. And so that, this, you know, in the Passover story, the lamb is slaughtered and then the blood is put on the door frame so that the angel of death does not come into that house. They'll just pass over those houses. And so in John's gospel, Jesus is the one being sacrificed that day to kind of take care and to say death does not need to come to these houses.
Yes.
And so in that case, it definitely feels, you know, of a, you know, Jesus is taking the place of a sacrifice, is, you know, being used as the sacrifice to encompass us or to wash away our sins as humanity. And to, to take over that the need for forgiveness for those sins. And there's, I mean, golly, there's so many different theories on atonement and what Jesus' crucifixion means. We can't get into all those today.
Yeah, that's a notoriously difficult theological subject. You know, I serve on the board of ordained ministry, and we interview candidates for ministry, and there's a portion of their work they turn into us, and the interview process is theological. They have to do some theological work, and we have a conversation around that. And there's a question about the atonement, and one of the tricky things is that the United Methodist Church, historically, you look at our kind of theological statement in our Book of Discipline, is we don't subscribe 100% to one particular atonement theory.
No.
And so we kind of, which makes sense with the United Methodist tradition. We're not first of all known as kind of an academic kind of theological tradition. We're more kind of experiential, relational tradition. And so if you look at the hymns of Charles Wesley, there's elements of substitutionary atonement and Christus Victor and all these kind of atonement theories kind of at work in Charles Wesley's hymns and in the preaching of John Wesley as well. But it's not something we like, okay, this is the this is a precise atonement theory of Methodism. We just don't have that.
Right. Well, we like to hold down that center. And
we're really good at that.
We're really good on not saying or coming down on one side or the other and saying, yes, that sounds great. Which, you know, we don't need to get into denominational stuff, but not necessarily. There's good and bad for all that.
Yeah.
And we're living through.
Oh, why not, Jim? Let's just go. Let's just let's go down that road. I'm sure everybody would be fascinated by that.
I'm sure. Well, going back to the crucifixion in Galatians 1 verse 4, it says he gave himself for our sins so he could deliver us from the present evil age according to the will of our God and Father. You know, so that right there kind of leads, there's a little bit of both in there that, you know, he gave himself. Right. So it's almost, you know, a willingness to do it, but then according to the will of God.
Right.
So it was, yes, on his part, but then not only on his part, but God and the Son, the Father and the Son are the one and the same yet different. And so, yeah.
Yeah,
it can get confusing quick.
If you want to get into, like, Paul has a lot to say about Jesus' sacrifice, especially, you look at Philippians 2, which it leans more towards Christ's agency and choosing that, and which is where Paul leans. You look at Romans where, that God proves his love for us. And this is in Romans 5, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Mm-hmm. So that was something that was not thrust upon him, but something that was chosen.
Right.
And there's a point in the Gospel of Mark, I believe. I think it's at the end of chapter 8 or maybe right after. I think it might be right after the Transfiguration, chapter 9, where it says Jesus turned his face to Jerusalem.
Right.
And they begin that journey to Jerusalem, and Jesus knows what's waiting there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like that moment when Theon decides to charge into, charge into the fight against the White Walkers. There's that moment where their decision's made. I know what's happening, and I'm doing it willingly.
But then, the prayer in the garden where he's, asking God, hey, if there's any other way for this not to happen, I'm willing for that to happen. And then in the end, it's kind of, all right, your will be done, God.
Uh-huh.
I will go into this next day, which is when he's crucified and dies, he goes in it willingly. But then there's some skepticism of like, hey, if there's any other way besides this, that would be great. That's kind of like a main idea of sacrifice. But there's some other ones within Scripture as well. Probably one of the other ones that are thought of is Isaac.
Right.
And being offered up as a sacrifice. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is more in the Shireen Hodor territory here.
Yeah.
Because at no point in the proceedings does Isaac is he aware.
Right.
Even up at the last minute while Abram is preparing the altar and Isaac is building the very altar on which he is getting ready to be sacrificed, Isaac's like, Dad, where's the sacrifice?
Did we forget something back at camp?
Yeah, didn't see you carrying a ram up here. What's going on?
Right.
Abram's like, God will provide. And which is what happens.
Yes.
And so that's, watching that whole Shireen moment, I was kind of waiting for that moment. Where's the replacement?
Right. For the ram to show up and somebody else be able to be offered up except for this innocent girl.
Yeah, but it didn't happen. That's a really disturbing story. It's a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly one of the most prominent stories of sacrifice in Scripture.
Yeah.
So what do you think, what are your ideas about kind of what's behind that story? Like what is what's the purpose of that story?
Yeah, I think it's, if I was teaching I'm actually leading Disciple 1, and we just finished up the Old Testament, so we're kind of reflecting back, and I think it's teaching Abraham that the loyalty and to make sure that God is loyal, or that Abraham is loyal to following God, and also that God will provide.
Right.
That there has to be a trust, there has to be a faith in God and what God says. And I think if Abraham was like, nope, this is too much, I can't sacrifice this son of mine that I've been waiting 100 years to have, that you said would actually, be, you promised this for Sarah and I, and now that my son is here and you want me to sacrifice him to you, we wrestle with that all the time. Like, why would God ask this? But I think that point is like, how much faith are we willing to follow God no matter where God leads?
Yeah.
It's still really hard to figure out, and not saying that's the best answer either.
Yeah. Like looking at the purpose of the story, kind of taking like how that story would have been read and how it functioned in the history of ancient Hebrew people. Like the other tribes and nations that kind of were surrounding the Hebrews, the Jews, child sacrifice was, I don't know if it's frequent, but it happened.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been a shock for that to happen in that ancient world.
And so this story kind of, like, if you look at it from a kind of a a perspective of this story is some kind of indication of something that was happening in ancient culture. It reflected kind of a development away from child sacrifice.
Hmm.
So this story is kind of saying, okay, we're going to give you – to the ancient people, we're giving you this familiar image of a child being carried to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
So for ancient cultures, this would not have been as shocking as it is to us today,
right?
By and large, I think. And so that the kind of the swerve twist ending would have been an indication, okay, for the Jewish people, child sacrifice is forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do this. Even though it's something that the people around you have done and participated in, this is not part of who we are. So I find an interesting interpretation of Genesis to be kind of, if you look at it, not so much focused on individuals, but you understand that like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph are kind of stand-ins, so to speak, for a large group of people. And what they experience in the narrative is actually kind of teaching us about what the ancient Hebrew people actually endured.
Mm-hmm.
So that when God provides an animal sacrifice instead of Isaac, that's the people of that's the Hebrew people leaving or refusing to participate in child sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. And knowing that God is providing a different way.
Yeah, it's less about the faith of an individual and more about kind of where God is leading this people. That child sacrifice is not what their faith is going to be about.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at it more from a sociological or cultural vantage point, I mean, it's still a disturbing story, of course, but it's actually kind of more that helps me get my head around that story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
It helps me to wrap my head around that, you know, the way that God has for his people is not the way of child sacrifice. So God has a better way.
Yeah. Well, there's other stories of sacrifice that make us go, what?
Yeah, what?
And Jephthah, I can't ever say his name.
Jephthah.
Yes, thank you. The story of his daughter. And,
yeah, Jephthah's daughter in Judges.
Yeah. Well, Judges is a weird book anyway. I mean, if you want to talk about a rated R, sex, violence, and just weird things happening, Judges would be on the top of my list of...
I'm telling you, man, if, like, this is a Game of Thrones podcast... I wish somebody like you could take the book of Judges and make a show that looks very much like Game of Thrones.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it is, and you know, we don't have time to delve too deeply in some of these stories, but I mean, it's vivid characterization. It's such an effective book, like a transition book from, kind of the ancient Israelites, their tribal, their transition from tribal to monarchy.
Right.
Because by the end of the book of Judges, it's basically anarchy. And actually says everybody did what was right in their own minds, which to us as Americans sounds really cool until you realize what everybody wanted to do was steal and kill and rape and pillage.
Right. And so like Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it's anarchy. And so this is what – by the time we get to the end of Judges, it becomes really clear why the people are crying out for a king.
Right.
And what they've done is kind of they've – you know, God has told them – you're a distinct people. You're a different people. You're a chosen people. Don't worship idols. And like the first thing they did was worship idols.
Well, I mean, if we want to look at once again, we don't have time, but the Old Testament itself is just a cycle of I'm going to follow you, God. Oh, we're going to not follow you. And then back and forth. If I want to follow you, nope, we're going to do our own thing, back up and down.
Right.
Which is just human nature because we still do the same thing these days.
Yeah. And we Christians too often we have this habit of like, pointing a finger of judgment at ancient Israelites, the Jewish people, as if we're better somehow.
Right.
But you know, this is not about a particular characteristic of Israel. This is about humanity.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we find the story of Jephthah in at the end of Judges 11, and he says to the Lord, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whoever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return victorious from the Ammonites, I'm going to kill them.
Right. I'm going to offer them up as a sacrifice if you can make me win this battle.
Which, I mean, God, you don't hear God's voice here. God doesn't say, that sounds like a deal, Jephthah. I mean, this is all kind of contained in Jephthah. Jephthah is driving this whole ship. You know, at no point does God say, I demand a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Jephthah just makes a vow, and then he fulfills it.
Well, it reminds me of those things that we say to ourselves, like, oh, Lord, if my team wins, I will go back to church on Sunday.
And then, I hope they're not a Panthers fan saying that, because you're missing a lot of church.
That's exactly right.
Maybe it should be, if I go to church, maybe the Panthers will win. Maybe you're getting it out of order.
Yeah, could be. Maybe next season.
Well, don't hold your breath. I'm a Tar Heel fan, so.
Yeah, y'all are having such a great year.
Church a lot. It's hard. Anyway. Jephthah.
Yeah, so he gives this kind of, hey, if I can win this battle, if I can defeat the Ammonites, that, you know, I will sacrifice whoever walks out of my door first.
That's just dumb.
It is, and I'm always curious, because the story never tells us, like, who else is living there?
Yeah, like
who was he thinking, like, oh, you know what, my butler usually comes and greets me first, and I'm tired of him, so I'll be happy to sacrifice him.
Maybe his jerk cousin is living with him, like, it's freeloading, like, living on his couch, like, sleeping on his couch. It's like, man, how do I get rid of this guy?
Right.
Oh, I know.
it's his mother-in-law. He's like, oh, please, come out the door.
It's really convoluted.
It is. But so it is, and his daughter comes out, and all of a sudden he has instant regret.
Yeah, and his daughter, like, God bless her. You know, if that were my daughter, she'd be like, no. But his daughter just like, oh, okay, whatever you say, Dad.
Well, then she like takes a 2-month trip with her friends to go cry around the hills.
Yeah, I think the biblical phrase there is to mourn her virginity, which is a slightly what it means is to mourn the fact that she never married and never had kids.
Right. Her life was not fulfilled.
Yes.
And yeah, but then she comes back. Which, if this was my daughter, she would just never have come back.
Yeah, just go. Keep going.
She would have said, all right, I'm out of here, and I'm going to go build my life somewhere else.
She comes back. Maybe she's thinking maybe Dad's changed his mind.
Yes, but he didn't.
No.
And he fulfills his promise, which is sad. And, you know, it's just one of those stories. You know, I was going through this story with a group, and we all kind of paused and said, why is this even in here?
Well, I think about this because Judges, like – Joshua and Judges are stories that are books that a lot of times non-Christians will use kind of to accuse Christians of worshiping a warlike, you know, God who just kills a bunch of people.
Hmm.
And if you look at the historical context of these stories, it's not a reflection so much of the nature of the God we worship. I mean, to me, as a Christian, that's revealed fully in Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace.
Right.
This story is a reflection of kind of, and especially the end of Judges, it's a reflection of how far this people have fallen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that story is not a reflection of God, but more a reflection of basically the breakdown of society.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of disobedience and, you know, as a result of committing themselves to horrendous acts of violence, which in my own personal view, they commit heinous acts of violence and attribute it to God.
Right.
And
we do that all the time. We say, hey, look, front space at Walmart opened up. I must be in God's favor. So we're no better than they are.
Yeah. God. Which the appropriate response is, especially if you're a healthy person who's a Christian, the appropriate response is, look, that parking place that's really close is open. I'm going to park in the back so somebody who might need it more than me can have it.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course. So, that's what Jesus would do.
And that sound is me stepping off my high horse.
So. Yeah. But I thought this was a great story that's, you know, kind of just points at that another sacrifice that was not this daughter's choice.
Right.
But yet she is brought into that fold of, you know, then sacrificing herself so that they could defeat the Ammonites. So,
yeah, and there are there are others you can think about. Bathsheba's husband Uriah, who was offered as a sacrifice.
Yeah, that I would definitely think that was David is kind of, or that's a little finger move right there.
It is a little finger move.
Yeah.
David, another one of those complex characters. I mean, and there are other examples throughout Scripture of ideas of sacrifice, either against a person's will or something they willingly choose.
Would you lump martyrdom up with sacrifice?
Certainly.
So you could actually look at Stephen, who was the first, Christian martyr who died for his faith. I would 100% agree that's dying or sacrificing yourself for what you actually believe.
Yeah, and that's a – then you go kind of beyond Scripture into the history of the Christian faith. Martyrdom was a huge part of Christianity in the first few centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when the Christian religion was kind of legitimized by Rome in the Western world, that kind of tradition fell off. But it's still very much prominent in parts of the world today where Christians face the threat of persecution and martyrdom. It's so outside kind of our American bubble.
Yes.
That we've kind of rejected a notion of personal sacrifice. So many times in our culture, people assume, the barista at Starbucks not saying Merry Christmas is persecution.
Right.
Which to me is an insult to our brothers and sisters, say, in North Korea or China or those Christians who happen to live in Saudi Arabia, Middle East, whose lives are very tenuous and risky based on their faith.
Yeah, and who literally could die because of their faith.
Absolutely, and do.
Yes.
Not to reveal too much of my opinions here, but hey.
No, I'm right there with you. The war on Christmas and that sort of thing just drives me nuts.
Yeah.
That's just our entitled majority.
This idea that everything has to revolve around me and my own particular worldview.
Right.
It's a particularly 21st century American phenomenon, I think.
Yeah. And I have more thoughts and feelings, but I don't think we need to take up any more time.
Yeah, this episode's gone on.
It has, but I think it's been good. It's sacrifices at the heart of not only the Game of Thrones with, people dying for the sake of power. And I mean, we could have gone on and on with people who died so that others can seek power. We also see a lot of it in the Bible, and it's at the core of, Christ's sacrifice is at the core of what we believe and why we believe what we believe.
Yeah.
So it's an important topic.
Absolutely.
We appreciate you all listening to this episode, and we want to continue the conversation with you. Do you agree with what was said, or do you have any questions? Join us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/theologyof and continue the conversation there. You can also email us at theologyofpodcast@gmail.com. If you don't mind, please leave us a rating and a review on whatever platform you're listening to us on. And if you enjoyed this episode, share it with some friends or post it on your social media page. That'll help us get the word out about what we are doing in here and how much you are enjoying it. We'd like to thank again the composer of our theme music this season, Dustin Shelton. I am Jim Parsons. On behalf of Wes Smith, we'd just like to thank you once again for listening to The Theology Of.